Our stories today take place in the time frame of about 550 to 600 years before Jesus came, 550 to 600 BC. And we've seen over the past few months of studies that over the hundreds of years before that, the nation of Israel had trouble remaining faithful to God. The northern half of Israel was then conquered by the Assyrians and ceased to exist. The southern half, called Judah, we saw some high times and some low times there. But eventually God then took them away as well. But rather than allowing them to cease to exist, He took them away for 70 years, is what Jeremiah said, to sit in the think about it chair in a place called Babylon. And so during these 70 years of exile is when the stories in the book of Daniel take place. Today we're going to cover the first stories in the first three chapters, and then next week we'll cover the stories in the next three chapters, chapters 4 through 6. There's a whole lot of other chapters behind that, but we won't cover those in this class. They deal with prophecy, and there's all sorts of interpretations there. We will see some prophecy today, and these prophecies are pretty clear because they have happened. They hadn't happened at Daniel's time, but they have happened. So we'll get into that. But during these stories, the Israelites or the Jews, the southern nation of Judah, all of those who still exist live in Babylon. So what is Babylon? Let's look a little bit about what Babylon is. Well, how old is it? Well, if you go way back, way, way back, back to the beginning, the book of beginnings, Genesis, okay, chapter 10, okay, you've got some stories there before chapter 10, but if you remember, the whole world was wiped out in a flood. And we have those in the chapters preceding. Then in chapter 10, it tells us what happened with Noah's descendants. Every one of us in this room descended from Noah. Okay, all other family lines were wiped out in that flood. So if we look at that, we see in the first verse that this is the account of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, who are Noah's sons. So we're all descendants of one of those three sons of Noah. And going on, we see that in verse 6, that Ham, his sons were Cush, Mitraim, Put, and Canaan. Okay, well, we've heard of Canaan, right? That's the land of Canaan is where the Israelites went, and that land was given to the Israelites. Put, we think, is in Africa, further away in Africa. Mitraim, in fact, that's still the Hebrew word today for Egypt. Okay, so that's Egypt. And then Cush. Well, who was Cush? Well, if you go on, you then see the sons of Cush. But if you look at verse 8, it says that Cush was the father of Nimrod. Okay, a guy named Nimrod. And he grew to be a mighty warrior on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. That's why it said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Now, Nimrod built a bunch of cities. And the first centers of his kingdom were Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in Shinar, or Shinar, however you want to pronounce it. And from that land he then went on to Assyria, where he built Nineveh, Rehoboth-ir, Kala, and Rezin, which is between Nineveh and Kala, that is the great city. So we saw last week when we looked at the story of Jonah, we saw Nimrod had founded Nineveh. Well, now we see in verse 10 that he founded Babylon. And Babylon, if you look at all these cities, is the only one still around. Babylon is probably the world's oldest city. Okay, there are still people living there. It's there in Iraq. And it has been dug up by archaeologists, and it was an amazing city. It goes way back to this time. We can see just in chapter 11, big story in chapter 11 revolves around the city of Babylon. And let's look at that. We'll go ahead and read the whole story. Now, the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar. Okay, that area in Mesopotamia there, this is right where the Babylon is called Shinar, and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." So they used brick instead of stone and tar from mortar, and they said, "Come, let's build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth." And we studied this story many months ago, we saw that one command that God had made to Noah was to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Okay, scatter. And here they're saying, no, we don't want to scatter. Let's make this tower so that we won't scatter. Plus, said, let's make a name for ourselves. Let's make this tower. This is a ziggurat that they were making, which is a tower to the gods. But this is going to be a name for themselves, a ziggurat to themselves, not to God. So Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. So as high as they could make it, God still had to come down to see it. Yahweh said, if as one people speaking the same language they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. So come, let's go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. This is the new human race that's in its infancy, and it needs to get started on the right foot, and this is not the right foot. So the Lord scattered them from there all over the earth, and they stopped building the city. That's why they called it Babel, because there Yahweh confused the language of the whole world. From there Yahweh scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So the Tower of Babel, the Tower of Babylon, okay, Babylon, that's... So the Tower of Babel has its story there. Now, if you look at a map, you'll see it. It's located on the Euphrates River, about 50 miles south of Baghdad, Iraq. Okay, Saddam Hussein was trying to rebuild Babylon. But what they found when archaeologists dug it up years ago is it was a huge, huge place. The walls went around 60 miles, okay, so it's a huge city. The walls were up to 300 feet tall. That's a football field tall, stand up a football field at that tall, and up to 87 feet wide, okay, so 30 yards wide, a third of a football field. So very thick, tall walls, very impressive place. Again, it had a lot of history. We see the history back to Nimrod and the Tower of Babel. Later on, during Abraham's time, which is around 2000 BC, the Amorites ruled between 2000 and 1600 BC, which is the time of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the patriarchs there. After the Amorites, the Hittites conquered them and ruled, and then the Kassites, and then the Assyrians. So we saw this is what would be called the Old Babylonian Dynasty, is these various dynasties, these various ancient time leaders. Now, the Neo-Babylonian Empire, or when you think of the Babylonian Empire, the heyday of the Babylon, was founded in 625 BC by a guy named Nabopolassar. Okay, Nabopolassar. And Nabo, or Nabu, is one of the big gods there. So Nabopolassar was named after his god. And he was a Chaldean, so he wasn't from that area. Chaldeans were from northeast Arabia. And so he came, and he allied with the Medes, okay, with a guy named Cyaxares, who was the king of the Medes, and together they conquered the great world power of Assyria. Okay, the Assyrians are the ones that we saw that destroyed the northern nation of Israel, and so they were conquered by the Babylonians here, from Nabopolassar and the Medes. Now, after he conquered Assyria, then he had to rule a government, rule a nation, and so he sent his son, a guy named Nebuchadnezzar, a name that you've probably heard of, and you'll hear of a lot over the next few days, or next week. Nebuchadnezzar was sent to lead his battles and to clean up the area, and you know, all these nations that the Assyrians had conquered that were now under Assyrian rule, well, the Babylonians, to keep the empire together, had to make sure that those people stayed together and didn't rebel. Plus, there were others to have. The biggest thing was Egypt, and a big threat with Egypt, and the Babylonians and the Egyptians fought each other, and the Egyptians lost. But you can see that from a strategic perspective, the land of Judah would be a good land to keep under Babylonian rule so that the as a first level of defense against the Egyptians, because the Egyptians would have to come through that area to go to attack Babylon. Well, Nabopolassar died in September of 605 BC, so he was just there for 20 years. And when he died, his son Nebuchadnezzar took over. And Nebuchadnezzar is the one who really turned Babylon into a world power. He was very expansion-oriented and conquered other territories and was a very successful conqueror. Very strong ruler, very great builder and administrator. We see, you know, you've heard of Solomon and his great building enterprises and maybe Herod the Great, but Nebuchadnezzar was huge. He took this city on the river and turned it into a major. His goal was that Babylon would be the greatest city in the world, and he did some things that made that happen. One of the things that helped him is that when he did conquer people, he brought the people there to Babylon to be his workers, such as the Jews. Okay, so he had this labor force that was able to do the work for him. Well, where did Nebuchadnezzar get his power, and what kind of reputation did he have? Well, if we turn to Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 6 to 7, it says, God says, I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places that are not their own. They are feared and dreadful people, dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. Okay, and it goes on talking about them. So where did he get his power? From God. God gave him the power so that he would come in and provide the judgment against the southern nation of Judah that God wanted invoked. Okay, but you see, they had a ruthless, feared, self-promoting reputation. Nebuchadnezzar, he reigned for a number of years, and when he died, his son Evil-Merodach took over. That was in 562 BC, so that shows you about 43 years, I guess, Nebuchadnezzar was king. And Evil-Merodach only lasted a couple of years, and then his son Nergal-Sharezer reigned for 4 years, and then Labashi-Marduk took over and reigned a year, and then they were conquered by Nabonidus in a coup in 555 BC. Now, Nabonidus, who took over then, didn't really pay a whole lot of attention to being a leader. He just liked the luxuries that were involved. So he retired after he became king and went to Tema in Arabia and left his son Belshazzar in charge. And we'll hear about Belshazzar next week. It was during Belshazzar being in charge that Cyrus the Mede, or the Persian, from further east, which is Iran today, conquered Belshazzar and Babylon in 539 BC. Okay, so he had 15, 16 years there. What's interesting is, although the Babylonian Empire was very powerful, very expansive, it took the borders of Assyria and the Assyrian Empire and took it even further, and very famous. Okay, you've heard of the Babylonian Empire. Their hanging gardens in Babylon were one of the seven wonders of the world. But the empire was very short-lived. It only lasted 86 years from the time that Nabopolassar took over and to the time that Cyrus the Mede conquered Belshazzar. That was only 86 years. So a short-lived, but although it was very famous and powerful, and it accomplished its purpose, which was God's purpose, to bring judgment to the Jews, send them into exile for 70 years, and we'll see that history is his story, is God's story. Not only did he raise up the Babylonians for this short time to bring them into exile, but he kept it a short time and allowed the Persians to come in, and the Persians had a policy then of releasing the political prisoners, such as the Jews who were there in Babylon, and also had a desire to appease the gods of those people. And we'll see that as we talk about in a few weeks about Nehemiah and Ezra and when the Jews come back to Jerusalem. Okay, So that's the story of Babylon. So what about the story of Daniel? Well, let's remind ourselves how the Jews got there, okay? When was it that the Judah first became subject to Babylon? Turn back to 2 Kings chapter 24. Verse 1 says that during Jehoiakim's reign, if you remember the kings that we've talked about, Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, invaded the land, and Jehoiakim became his vassal for 3 years. Now, this would have been in 605 B.C., when Nebuchadnezzar took over. Soon after he became king, he sent his armies to go and make Judah a vassal, subject to Babylon. And then, soon after, in verse 1 still, he changed, after 3 years, Jehoiakim changed his mind and rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, stopped paying the tribute. Well, the Babylonians are power. Nebuchadnezzar has power. He's powerful. And rebelling against him, deciding not to pay him his protection money, is not necessarily a good idea. So what happened then? We've got the story in Kings and Chronicles, but we can also look at Daniel, our first two verses of Daniel. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Okay. So Nebuchadnezzar captured Jehoiakim and took the temple articles back to Babylon. Did he take back anything else with his first exile? Back to 2 Kings, verse 13. As Yahweh had declared, Nebuchadnezzar removed all of the treasures from the temple of Yahweh, from the royal palace, and took away all the gold articles that Solomon, the king of Israel, had made for the temple of Yahweh. He carried into exile all of Jerusalem, all the officers and fighting men, and all the craftsmen and artisans, a total of 10,000. Only the poorest people of the land were left. Nebuchadnezzar also took Jehoiachin, okay, who was Jehoiakim's son, captive to Babylon. He also took from Jerusalem to Babylon the king's mother, his wives, his officials, and the leading men of the land. He also deported to Babylon the entire force of 7,000 fighting men strong and fit for war, and 1,000 craftsmen and artisans. So anything and anybody of value he took to Babylon. Okay, so that's this first exile when he took this first batch, anything, and just left the poorest people of the land. Included in that group, we see in Ezekiel, it says, on the fifth of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin, the word of Yahweh came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, by the Kibar River in the land of the Babylonians. There the hand of Yahweh was upon him. So during that first exile, this guy named Ezekiel was taken, and we learned that he was a priest, the son of a priest, and God called him to be a prophet, but not until after he had already spent 5 years in exile in Babylon. Okay, God called him from Babylon. Before they went to Babylon, the language of the Jews, the language of the Israelites, was Hebrew. All the books were written in Hebrew. When they got to Babylon, though, the common language was Aramaic, and that was a language that the Assyrians spoke, and that was a language that the Babylonians then spoke. It was the common world language. So the Israelites began speaking Aramaic while they were in Babylon. That is the language that Jesus spoke. Okay, so Aramaic became the common language of the people from the time they were in Babylon. Well, Nebuchadnezzar had these well-educated and capable men that had been brought to Babylon. What did he do with them? Okay, he had building campaigns, but surely he didn't just take the smart guys and send them out to build his building projects, or did he? Verse 3. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. Ashpenaz was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. So, and he didn't just do this with the Jews. He did this with all of the peoples that he had conquered, is took the most promising looking young men that that were smart, intelligent, could be trained, and had them trained, put them through a 3-year boot camp to teach them the Babylonian language, the Babylonian ways, and prepare them for service as advisors to the king. Now, some of the guys from the camp of Judah, we see in verse 6, among these were some from Judah, Daniel, okay, there we see Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Okay, there's three other guys that you may or may not have heard of. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. All four of these were probably teenagers, probably 16 or so years old, that kind of age. Okay, but going on, the names that you might know those guys by, it says the chief official gave them new names, gave them Babylonian names. Okay, these names, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, were all names pertaining to Yahweh. He gave them names pertaining to Babylonian gods. And they were, to Daniel, he gave the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. So there you see, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's probably the names that you know them by. Well, what do all those names mean? Daniel, the name Daniel means God is my judge, but his name was changed to Belteshazzar. Bel was the chief god of the Babylonians, and so Belteshazzar means Bel's prince. Hananiah means Yahweh is gracious, and Shadrach, his name was changed to Shadrach, which means inspired by the sun god. Okay, inspired by the sun god. Mishael, that name means who is what God is, or another way to say that is who is comparable to God. Meshach, now they kept the first syllable and added the word shak to refer to the goddess Shishak. And then Azariah means Yahweh helps, and his name was changed to Abednego, which means servant of the fire god. If you look at these four new Babylonian names, they were tied to the top four Babylonian gods. Okay, we already said that Bel was the chief god. Okay, then you had the sun god that Shadrach was named after, the earth god that Meshach was named after, and the fire god that Abednego was named after. Okay, the chief god, the sun god, the earth god, the fire god. And those were the top four gods of Babylon. All right, these guys from Judah, they were put into this boot camp, but they had trouble right away. And what trouble was that? Verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. Okay, this is the royal food and wine we saw in verse 5 that the king assigned to these boys in training. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. So he didn't want to eat the royal food and wine. And so he asked for permission not to do so. Why? What was the problem with that? Well, for one thing is the food that was given to the king, the first portions of that would have been offered as sacrifice to the gods, to Bel, to Shishak, to Nebo, okay, to the various gods, or Nebu, however you want to pronounce it. And God talks about that. Exodus 34, verse 15, God says, "Be careful not to make a treaty with those who live in the land, because when they prostitute themselves to their gods and sacrifice to them, they will invite you and you will eat their sacrifices." So just as God had warned, you don't want to eat the food of the pagans because it could be polluted by sacrifice. Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 13, God said, "In this way the people of Israel will eat defiled food among the nations where I will drive them." And sure enough, that's what they're trying to do here. This is defiled food having been offered to idols. And Daniel doesn't want any part with it. And that's a concern that he had. Do we need to be concerned? Do we need to be concerned about eating food that people offer us? You know, if we go to visit with someone who is a different faith, do we need to be concerned about their food and Paul talks about that. Romans 14, starting in verse 14, he says, talking about himself, as one who is in the Lord Jesus, I am fully convinced that no food is unclean in itself. But if anyone regards something as unclean, well then, for him, it is unclean. If your brother's distressed because of what you eat, well then you're no longer acting in love. Do not, by your eating, destroy your brother for whom Christ died. Do not allow what you consider good to be spoken of as evil. No food is unclean, he says, but don't eat it if it bothers your brother. Okay, if others are bothered and if they see it as being unclean and that could hurt their faith, their relationship with God by you eating it, just don't eat it. In 1 Corinthians 10, he also says, eat anything sold in the meat market without raising any questions of conscience, because the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. But you know, if some unbeliever invites you to a meal and you want to go, eat whatever is put before you without raising questions of conscience. But if anyone says to you, this has been offered in sacrifice, well then don't eat it. Both for the sake of the man who told you and for conscience's sake. The other man's conscience, I mean, not yours, for why should my freedom be judged by another man's conscience? Okay? If I take part in a meal with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of something I thank God for? So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jews or Greeks or the church of God. So the point that Paul makes here is, although the food is okay, and because it's just food and it's given to us by God, if eating it is a problem for someone else, then just don't eat it. Okay, eat something else. That's what Daniel asked for. Did have the official respond? Well, you know, this is a Babylonian. He goes, shut up and eat what's put in front of you, right? Verse 9. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. Okay, so the guy cared for Daniel. But the official told Daniel, I'm afraid of the Lord, of my Lord the king. You know, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't necessarily a guy you'd want to get on the bad side of, right? He's assigned you your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. So he's concerned if he doesn't eat the king's rations, then he will be unhealthy and will look unhealthy, and the king will be upset with that. And this guy could lose his head, not just his job, but his head. Well, how did Daniel convince the official to let him eat what he wanted? Going on. Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. And then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. Okay, if after 10 days we look scrawny, we don't look healthy, well then you can change it. But if we do, then you know, you decide. How did this test turn out? Going on. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. Okay. So they looked healthy, they were healthier than the others, so they were able to continue their diet of just vegetables and water. And then they go through this 3 years of training, and how did these four from Judah turn out after those 3 years? Verse 17, to these four young men, God gave, okay, there you go, God blessed them, and so what did he bless them with? Knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. So God blessed them with wisdom and knowledge and understanding and the ability to understand visions and dreams for Daniel. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. So these four were greatly blessed by God, and as a result, that blessing was recognized by Nebuchadnezzar. He saw that they were 10 times better than any of the other royal advisors, and so they entered the king's service. They passed their test. How long did Daniel remain in Babylon? Verse 21, and Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. Okay? Remember, Cyrus is the one who came in the Medo-Persian and came in and conquered Belshazzar, which we'll see next week, and brought an end to the Babylonian Empire. So he was there the whole time. Okay, he was there from the exile. He was there from the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's reign through the end of Babylon, the Babylonian Empire. We have another story in chapter 2. Let's start. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. Okay, and because of these dreams, his mind was troubled and he could not sleep. So, to satisfy himself, the king summoned the magicians, the enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I've had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means." Well, the astrologers answered the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it." So he had a dream, he had these dreams, and he needed to know what they meant. Okay, so he summoned his wise men to come and tell him that, and they said, "Okay, tell us." Now, this note here in verse 4, it says that the astrologers answered the king in Aramaic. Now, Aramaic was the common language in Babylon, and what's interesting now is, up until this point, the story in Daniel has been in Hebrew. Now it changes to Aramaic, and all the stories, everything that we have through chapter 7 is all in Aramaic. And then it goes back to Hebrew. So you've got both Hebrew and Aramaic in this book. So the wise men said, "Okay, tell us your dream, and we will be happy to interpret for you, king." Well, king put a twist on it, and that twist made it a little tough and kind of troubled the wise men about it. Let's look at that twist. The king replied to the astrologers, "This is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, then I'll have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble." Okay, so he's kind of testing them here. You know, if you really do have insight, then you not only know what my dream means, but you know what it is. You tell me what it is. Okay, and if you do tell me the dream and explain it in verse 6, you will receive from me gifts and rewards with great honor. So, tell me the dream and interpret it for me. Verse 10, the astrologers answered the king, "There is not a man on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they don't live among men." Okay, so he was asking the impossible. You tell me what my dream was. They don't know what his dream was. You got to tell us your dream and then we can interpret it. Well, how did Nebuchadnezzar respond to their response? Okay, once more they replied, verse 7, "Let the king tell his servants the dream and we'll interpret it." And the king answered, "I am certain that you are trying to gain time because you realize that this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there's just one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping that the situation will change. So then, tell me the dream, and I will know that you can interpret it for me." Okay? So he didn't trust him. And so he said, "You have to tell me the dream." And when they said that they can't, this made the king so angry and furious in verse 12 that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. "You obviously are just making this stuff up. You are not telling me the truth. If you can't tell me what my dream is, then you do not have the insight that you say you do." So he ordered them to death. Well, who are the wise guys? Who are the wise men? Who are these people who are sentenced to death now? Well, going on. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and the men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, "Why did the king issue such a harsh decree?" Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went in to the king and asked for time so that he might interpret the dream for him. Okay, so Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were all part of that group. And Daniel asked for some more time, and how did that stop the mass execution? Going on. Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. he urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So they decided they needed to pray. Okay? So they prayed. And then during the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. And then Daniel praised the God of heaven. And then we have some praise that he has here. Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He sets up kings and deposes them. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of you, and you have made known to us the dream of the king. So God revealed it to him. He got another day, prayed with his friends, and God revealed the mystery to him. So then, going on, Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and he said, "Do not execute the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king, and I will interpret the dream for him." So Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, "Hey, I found a man from among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream means." Well, the king asked Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, "Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it?" Daniel replied, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery that he's asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and the visions that passed through your mind as you lay on your bed were these. As you were lying there, O king, your mind turned to things to come, and the revealer of mysteries showed you what's going to happen. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because I have greater wisdom than the other living men, but so that you, O king, may know the interpretation and that you may understand what went through your mind." Okay, so Daniel says, "No, king, I cannot reveal your dream and tell you what it means, but God can, and God has revealed it to me, so I can reveal it to you and tell you what it means. Only God in heaven can reveal mysteries such as this." So, what was the dream? Going on. "You looked, O king, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, and then its legs of iron, and its feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, not by human hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were broken to pieces at the same time and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth." So they had this strange dream of this statue made with different metals. You got gold and silver and bronze and then iron and clay. And then you got this rock that comes and just smashes the whole thing, and actually smashes the feet, but the whole thing shatters and gets blown away, and there's no memory of it at all. But the rock then becomes some huge mountain that fills the whole earth. What a weird dream, but dreams are kind of weird. But this dream had great meaning, and it's interesting to see as we look at this too. Let's read first to see what he says the meaning is, and then we'll see how that actually played out in history. So, this was the dream, verse 36, "and now we'll interpret it to the king. You, O king, are the King of Kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he has placed mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. You are that head of gold. But after you, another kingdom will rise, inferior to yours." Okay, silver is inferior to gold, right? "Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze," okay, another step down, "will rule over the whole earth. And then finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom, yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with the clay. As the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. Okay, so that explains what's going to come. This statue was a sign of kingdoms that would come. The head, the golden head of the statue, was Nebuchadnezzar. That was the gold. Okay, gold is the most valuable, right? And you have gold being the valuable, and you look at the strength of Nebuchadnezzar. You look at the value that he had as a leader, and he had great value. Anything he said went. His word was law. Okay, his word was unrestricted. He had unrestricted authority. Whatever he decided it, and that's the way it was. Okay, but on the other hand, gold is kind of weak, right? If you can, it's malleable. It's not something you would build with, not just because of its value, but because it's not very strong structurally. Well, the Babylonian Empire, remember, it only lasted 86 years, so it wasn't very. It was strong while it was there, but it didn't last very long. Okay, it wasn't very durable. So we have the head of gold, and in Daniel chapter 2, verse 38, he identified that head is you. That head is Babylon. That head is Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, in Daniel 7, we have another vision, and this is a vision of four animals, or four beasts, or four creatures, and the lion that we see in Daniel chapter 7, verse 4, is the same thing as this head of gold. Okay, that vision then is just similar to this vision, saying the same sort of thing. Okay? So we have this string of empire builders, and it starts out with Babylon, starts out with Nebuchadnezzar, and that's what you see. Babylon is now this world empire. Okay? But then, after him, it says here, okay, after you, verse 39, another kingdom will rise inferior to yours. So silver is still valuable, but it's not as valuable as gold. And you take a look at the kings of the Persians and the Medes who took over. This is the Medo-Persian Empire. This is the next empire that came, the one that conquered the Babylonians. The kings of that, and we'll see this in next week's story, they could make rules, but they couldn't change rules. They couldn't change laws. Even a law that they put in place, they could not change it. So they had a restriction that they had to live by, where Nebuchadnezzar, he could change his mind every day if he wanted to. Okay, the king could not repeal his own law in the Medo-Persian. And you see that in Daniel 6, verse 12, which we'll look at next week. You also see in Daniel 7, verse 5, this is the bear. It's also in Daniel 8, there's another vision, and the ram that you see there is the Medo-Persian Empire. And it's identified as such there in chapter 8, verse 20. Now, silver is a little stronger than gold. Well, the Medo-Persian Empire was stronger than the Babylonians. It lasted 208 years and had 11 kings. Okay, so it lasted over twice as long as the Babylonian Empire. So it was stronger. Okay, so you have the head of gold, Babylonian Empire, chest and arms of silver, which were the Persians, the Medes and the Persians that took over then. And then we have the belly and thighs of bronze. And if you look at Daniel chapter 8, verse 21, there you have in that vision, the next thing after the ram is a shaggy goat. And there you see that in, it's identified as Greece. Okay, so this is the Greek Empire brought in by Alexander the Great. Now the value of bronze, you see the form of government there was not this despot, was not this dictator, but rather a more republican form of government. And so the leader was a little weaker. Okay, didn't have the strength to make the decisions on his own. Bronze is stronger than silver, which is stronger than gold. Well, the Greek Empire was even larger than the Persian Empire, which was larger than the Babylonian Empire, and it lasted between 260 and 300 years. So over three times as long as the Babylonian Empire. And then you have legs of iron and then feet of clay and iron mixed together. And the value of iron, well, it's not as valuable as bronze or silver or gold. So here, instead of a republican form, you had a more democratic republic. And so the king, the Caesar, didn't have nearly the strength that, say, the leader of the Greek Empire or the Persian Empire or the Babylonian Empire did. Its iron is stronger than bronze, which is stronger than silver and stronger than gold. Well, the Roman Empire had even more territory than the Greek Empire, and it lasted longer than any of the other empires as well. Now, you have this iron-clay mixture when you get down to the feet, and then you got 10 toes that are iron and clay and all that kind of stuff. And what that's referring to is the Roman Empire, it wasn't conquered by another empire. There's not a fifth world empire that comes next. Well, it kind of is. We'll see that in a second. But instead, it just kind of disintegrated. It broke apart. It eventually branched off into 10 different kingdoms. Okay, well, you got 10 toes, you got 10 kingdoms, right? And they've never been able to reunite again, such as what it says in verse 43 here. It says, the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. So the Roman Empire separated into 10 parts, and some of those kingdoms that it broke into were strong like iron, and some were weak like clay. Okay, so you get that iron and clay things. In Daniel 7, verse 7, this is the terrifying beast that you see in verse 7. That's what you see with that statue. Now, what about this rock? There's this rock here. What is that about? Going on, verse 44, it says, in the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. Okay, it's not going to be ruled by people. That's kind of weird, a kingdom that will last forever that won't be ruled by people. It will crush all of those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of the mountain, but not by human hands. A rock that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold to pieces. The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true, and the interpretation is trustworthy. So what is this rock? This rock that shattered these great empires in the statue? It's a God empire. It's an empire that God himself would establish. God himself would rule over, not by human hands, okay? No man would lead it. And it's a kingdom that would last forever. Well, what kingdom is that? Well, there's many verses we can look at. We'll just look at 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 11. It says, you will receive a rich welcome into the eternal kingdom of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. So the rock is Jesus. And you know, when was it that Jesus came? What was the great empire of the world when Jesus came? Rome. And sure enough, that's the last empire, and the rock took the place as the empire of the world, of the kingdom of the world. Okay? So this vision that we see in Daniel is not just a vision for Nebuchadnezzar's time. This is telling Nebuchadnezzar and us what would happen later. And sure enough, it all happened, just as Daniel said. Well, how did Nebuchadnezzar respond to this explanation that Daniel gave him? Going on. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and ordered that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you are able to reveal this mystery. Then the king placed Daniel in a high position and lavished many gifts on him. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and placed him in charge of all of its wise men. Moreover, at Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego administrators over the province of Babylon, while Daniel himself remained at the royal court. Okay? So he made Daniel the governor and the head advisor, and took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and made them officials that reported then to Daniel. But you see, first, what did he do? He praised God. He praised Yahweh. Your God is the God of gods, the Lord of lords, the King of kings, right? Well, what kind of reputation did Daniel get among the exiles in Judah, in Babylon, the Jewish exiles? What's interesting is if you look at another book that was written at the same time, Ezekiel mentions Daniel. Chapter 14, verses 13 and 14, and you can kind of see his reputation in this. He says, Son of man, if a country... Well, the word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, if a country sins against me by being unfaithful, and I stretch out my hand against it to cut off its food supply and send famine upon it and kill its men and their animals, even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they could save only themselves by their righteousness, declares the sovereign Lord. Okay? So Daniel is mentioned in the same righteous league, the same righteous group as Noah and Job, who were both recognized. Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord, and Job we see as one of the greatest men that ever, most faithful men that ever lived. And Daniel's put into that same mix by God here. Chapter 28, verse 3 of Ezekiel says, Are you wiser than Daniel? Is no secret hidden from you? So he's recognized as being the wisest man around in those days. Okay, so he's known for his wisdom. All right, going on, chapter 3. We saw a statue in chapter 2. Well, guess what? We got another statue in chapter 3. So let's look at that. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold 90 feet high and 9 feet wide and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, and advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officers and officials to come to the dedication of the image that he had set up. So he built this huge statue, 90 foot tall by 9 foot wide, which, you know, if you think about it, that's 9 stories tall. If you, here in Houston, we're familiar with the big Sam Houston statue in Huntsville, north of Houston. That is only, you know, you think how tall that is? That's only 67 feet tall. This was 90 foot tall. And this would have been a statue, most likely, that he made to Nabu. Nabu is the god that he was named after. Okay? And in fact, Nebuchadnezzar, his name meant, Nabu, protect my boundary. Okay? So he's looking at Nabu as being a protector. So he builds his statue to Nabu, and he calls all of his people together to this dedication of this statue. Okay? And so this is showing that... he's now in charge. Nabu is now going to is in support of Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, so he's kind of securing his kingship here. But he also uses this statue to test his subjects, we see. Going on. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, This is what you are commanded to do, O peoples, nations, and men of every language. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music. In other words, when you hear the orchestra get started and the band's playing, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Okay, so he gave them this test and said, whenever you hear the band play, you bow down to this statue and show your allegiance to it. And by showing your allegiance to the statue, to my namesake, God, then you're showing your allegiance to me. But if you refuse to show your allegiance to my namesake, to Nabu, the god, then I'll throw you in a fiery furnace, okay? In a burning furnace and burn you up. So we see that he did that and everyone did it, right? At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. Okay, astrologers, remember, who was the greatest wise man? Daniel was, okay? Daniel was in a high position, and he was put ruler over the entire province of Babylon, we saw in chapter 2, verse 48. So these people, and it says, and place him in charge of all of his wise men. So these people would have reported to Daniel, and they didn't like reporting to a Jew. Okay? And so they came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You have issued a decree, O king, that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But you know there are some Jews to whom you've set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, O king. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold that you've set up." Okay, so they turned in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego for not bowing down to the statue. It's interesting that they didn't turn in Daniel. I don't know if Daniel either wasn't there or if they were afraid of Daniel and were afraid, recognizing that the king thought highly of Daniel, and they didn't want to risk their own safety by turning him in, but they at least can get his buddies here, right? So, did Nebuchadnezzar accept this accusation? Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I've set up? Now, when you hear the sound of horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, if you're ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. And then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" So Nebuchadnezzar hears that accusation, and he goes to test it himself. And he gives these three a chance to either be guilty or innocent before him. He doesn't need witnesses. He'll be the witness. Okay? We're going to start the band up here in a minute. When the band plays, you bow down to the image of the god, and everybody will be happy. But if you don't, you're going to get suntan real heavy. Okay? So, what happened? Going on. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the god that we serve is able to save us from it. And he'll rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he doesn't, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you've set up." So they refused. They stood up. They stood up to King Nebuchadnezzar, this guy who'd have people's heads real easy. They stood up to him and said, "We will not worship your image of gold." Why did they take such a strong stand? Why did they make such a big deal about bowing down to a statue? You know, just bowing down, big deal, right? Well, turn to Exodus chapter 20. Okay? Rule number one of the Ten Commandments: you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, Yahweh your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So why did they make a big deal out of it? Because God had made a big deal out of it. This was commandment number one. Okay? So they did not want to bow down to this idol, to this other God. Why did they take such a bold stand against Nebuchadnezzar? You know, they're kind of just asking for trouble here, right? Well, you know, Peter does the same kind of thing back in Acts chapter 5. This is when he is before the Sanhedrin, and verse 28 it says, "We gave you strict orders not to teach in his name, yet you filled Jerusalem with your teaching and are determined to make us guilty of this man's blood." Okay, well, hey, they're working, okay? What they're doing is working. But look what Peter says. "Peter and the other apostles replied, 'We must obey God rather than men.'" This was the Sanhedrin he was talking to. They had great power. They could have done a lot to Peter. And he says, "No, we're not going to listen to you. We must obey God rather than men." And that's what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say. Well, how does Nebuchadnezzar respond to their rejection of his command? Okay, with this egotistical law here. Going on. Verse 19, "Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. and his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in the army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to throw them into a blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace was so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Okay? So he was furious with them saying no to him. And so he not only threw them in the flaming furnace, he had it heated up 7 times hotter, so hot that the soldiers who just took them to put them into the door, that the heat killed them. It was that hot. This furnace was probably a lime kiln, okay, that would cure lime, infuse lime. And this would have a walkway to an opening up in the top. So up in the top you would dump in the raw materials. And then there'd be an opening at the bottom for extracting out the fused lime. So they would have been thrown in at the top here and fallen into this this lime kiln. What happened to them while they were in there? Verse 24. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, "Weren't there 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace, so this would be the door at the bottom, and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out. Come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. How can you go into a furnace like this and not smell like fire? But they didn't even smell like fire. God had sent his angel to rescue them, to protect them from the flames. What did Nebuchadnezzar think about what he saw? Verse 28, then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than to serve or worship any god other than their own God." So he recognized that the God that they worship is God, that they were rescued by their God. So did he then decide, okay, well, that's the God. So did he give up on his other gods and turn to Yahweh? Going on. "Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces." Okay, your normal over-exaggeration for Nebuchadnezzar here. "Cut into pieces, and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way." So he recognized that God is God, that Yahweh was God, that the God of the Hebrews is God. But he didn't change. He still accepted his other gods. But he did have respect, as one of the gods is this God of the Hebrews. And he, realizing that Yahweh really is a God, he prohibited offenses against the gods of the Hebrews. How did he deal with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Verse 30. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to the province of Babylon. Or in the province of Babylon. So he promoted them. So they got a pay raise and a promotion out of this. Let's close with prayer. God our Father, we thank you for the stories of faith of the people who have preceded us, the faith of Daniel, who's put on a par with Noah and Job as an example of faith, someone who is living in a righteous relationship with you. Help us to learn more as we continue to go through his stories, to see his faith, so that we can emulate that in our own lives. We also thank you for showing us the faith of his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and that they were willing to stand up against powerful King Nebuchadnezzar and tell him no, that they would not sin against you, that they would be faithful to you, even though that meant that they would be killed. And they saw your great protective hand, and miraculous protection that you brought with your angel. And thank you for keeping that story for us so that we can see your love for your people, your care for your people, your protection of your people, that the example of these men in their faith. Thank you for sending your Holy Spirit in our lives so that we can live in that faith, faith that was brought to us by your Son, Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.